Okay, so Parshas Mishpatim in general is a parsha for us this year. We're learning Sanhedrin. And certainly this aliyah as well, the fifth aliyah, starts off directly addressing our Masechta, directly addressing things that we've talked about recently. So there's quite a lot in this aliyah. Each topic could really be a whole day's discussion itself, or at least a whole day's discussion. So we'll see how much we can quickly touch upon in the time that we have. So the fifth aliyah of Mishpatim begins, Lo sata mishpat evyoncha beriro, that you should not tilt the judgment of a poor person. So what exactly does that mean? The truth is it's interpreted on a couple of different levels. It sounds like it means that you would want to privilege a person who is poor. So that's true, there is certainly an element to that, and it's notable that the Rishalmi in Maseches Peah so emphasizes the word berivo and says that that's the context in which you should not favor the poor, but in the context of Matnas Aniyim, Leket Shechul Peah and the like, so that you should tilt towards him. Meaning that if there's a Safik in Staka, Safik in Matnas Aniyim, so certainly we want to do whatever we can to help out the poor, and in general we're trying to balance things in his favor. But we have to understand that there's different realms, that in the realm of Mishpat, in the realm of justice, we have to stick to the truth. Pshara is a whole different discussion, which God willing we'll get to in our parak pretty soon. But as far as a dying just deciding, okay, I'll let this guy win because he's poor, so that would be a perversion of the din, and that's not acceptable. The Mechilta has a whole different interpretation, which some of the Rishonim quote the Halacha. The Rambam quotes this in Sefer HaMitzvot, and Sefer HaChinuch quotes this, which is really an opposite kind of information. That it suggests that an Evyon is a reference here to an Evyon in Mitzvot, somebody who's lacking in merit. In other words, if somebody is not such a great guy, and he comes before you in Din, so you might say, all right, listen, this guy is a bum anyway, so let me tilt things against him because he deserves to lose. He deserves to be punished, if not for this, for something else. So maybe I will tilt the scale against him. So that's also wrong. It's wrong to do it either direction. It's wrong, pashup shat pashup, to have rachmanis on somebody just because he's poor in this context. And it's wrong to say I will be particularly against the person just because he's not a nice guy. That's also wrong. Okay. So the next pasuk is a doozy. Next pasuk is one that we certainly could speak about all day, but that would have other problems. So we'll just try to call attention to as much as we can in this pasuk. Midvar sheker tircha, never tell a lie. So is that what it means? So there's a lot of discussion to be had about this pasuk, midvar sheker tircha, which on the surface sounds like it means that there is a prohibition to tell a lie. It sounds like that is a direct translation. But there's a lot of discussion to be had about this. First of all, does this pasuk directly address any lie in any context? And is that all it addresses? Or does it have a broader scope? And a lot of that is prompted by the fact that it's unusual phrasing. Midvar sheker tirchok, stay away from sheker. So if the intent of the pasuk was simply to say, don't lie, so we know that there are different words the Torah can use for prohibition. The Gemara says there are four different words the Torah uses when it wants to give an isser, yishomer, pen, lav, ba'al. So the language of tirchok is something that requires a lot of discussion, a lot of analysis. What's the message? So there are those who take it to either extreme. You find some of the mepharshim who say that this is a hyper-isser, that this is a way of saying it's not just usser, it's really usser, and that when the Torah wants to prohibit something, it says, don't. And here, the Torah is using stronger language and saying, don't even come close, tirchok. That's the way to say it for Achinuch understands it. He says, meirov tiyuvo, this is so disgusting, the Torah is not satisfied with merely saying, don't. Alternatively, you have those who take it in a different direction and who assume that it doesn't necessarily mean to say that it's an absolute prohibition, but that it's something a little bit less than an absolute prohibition. And tirchok is a softer language. So this language does prompt a lot of suggestions as to why the Torah wouldn't just say don't, but would instead say stay away. It's reminiscent of the famous story of one of the Gedolim, could have been the Ragachov, or could have been someone else, who was asked to write a Haskama for someone. So he wrote the Haskama, and then there was a lot of space left, but he signed at the very bottom of the page. So they asked him, why did you sign so far down? So he responded, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. He doesn't want to put his name so close to the apparently less than fully accurate statements that he wrote in the Haskama. So what exactly is the intent of Tirchak? So it's a big discussion, and there are a lot of possibilities. So first of all, it seems like the Gemara is addressing this a little bit, because the Gemara and the Sefer Shavuos, there are a lot of citations of this pasuk in Shas, but particularly the Gemara in Sefer Shavuos and the Lamed and Bebeis, Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, has a number of applications which show that it's not just about not lying, but it's about not allowing lying to happen, even unintentionally, even through someone else, even participating. So just among the drushas you find in the Gemara, and later sources you find other such statements. But in the Gemara, you see, for example, the Gemara there says that a dayan shouldn't make sanigorim. Now, what's a sanigorim? So sanigorim means defense agents. So the way the Torah Tamima and Hirsch and others read that phrase is it means that, let's say, the dayan realizes while he's analyzing the case that he's traveling down the wrong path and he starts to make a mistake. So human nature might be that a person is going to want to assume that he's correct, so he'll start trying to defend, to bolster the position that he assumed to be true. So therefore, the Torah has to instruct that, no, don't try to defend your position mentally, but recognize that you might be wrong, and don't allow a sheker to happen because you're so committed to your initial instinct, which is related a little bit to what we saw yesterday, that interesting pshat from the Adi Yisrael about the Alti Dan Yechidi, that we're worried that one person taking a situation is going to first have a certain bias, and then it's going to be very hard to overcome that bias. It's interesting, and it's a current controversy, but that here the Torah Tamima comments in that sense on the Sanigorin usage. Elsewhere, in Parshat Mishpatim actually, he has a whole different discussion about that phraseology, and he takes a punch, he takes an attack on what is very prevalent in contemporary Bate Din. He says that it's wrong for a Bez Din, for a Dayan, to allow advocates, what's known as Tonim nowadays, and which is a controversial institution, people who hire representatives to speak for them in Bez Din. So the Torah Tamima wrote strongly that he thought that that was a violation of this idea of Sanigorim. It's going to, again, take away from the truth. And Schechter has often spoken very strongly against such institutions as well. And he explains that a part of it, part of the whole job of the dayan, is the dayan is supposed to assess what the people sound like. It's supposed to assess whether they sound credible or not. And if the words are coming through an advocate, so then it's hard to know whether he's telling the truth or not because he's representing somebody else. The dayan is supposed to hear directly from the people. And that's a part of the issue here also, that that's also going to contribute to a lack of emes, if the dayan isn't fully allowed to try to assess just how credible the people in front of him actually are. Question about that?
Again, from the pasuk or from the Gemara of Sanhedrin?
So the Torah Tamima has this comment in a different pasuk where he interprets the word in that sense. Here he doesn't say it. But it does seem to connect to this whole consideration, and something that the Gemara does connect to this pasuk, which is related, is that this point about assessing the emes, you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect. If we learn Sanhedrin, like we're learning, we learned about Metzia a few years ago. So it looks like there's rules for everything. This person is toning this, he gets this. A person claims that, he loses. A person claims that, he wins, etc., etc. So it seems like there's basically an algorithm. You fit in all the claims and all the tainas, and that's what happens. But if you read any Gedolim story, so it's always different, right? So someone had two people came in front of the Chassam Sofer, and they had a Din Torah, and the Chassam Sofer said, oh, look over there, and there was a bird, and he threw some paint in the air, and he says, oh, I see that you're guilty. So you know, it doesn't seem to match what we read about in Shulchan Aruch, or what we learn about in our sugyas. So the pshat is that really there's two levels, that the dayan's real job is just to try to figure out who's honest and who isn't, who's telling the truth, where the accuracy really is. And then, if there's no other way to be mevarer further what the story is, so then we'll fall back on these principles of he's towing this, he's towing that, and that's the whole story. But if a Dayan is able to ascertain that one of the parties is not telling the truth, so that's his first job. So that is one of the drushas the Gemara has. On Lamed Aleph and Aleph and Shavuos, the Gemara says that the idea is that a Dayan shouldn't say, well, I see that this is not really true. I see that what's happening here, I don't really buy it. I think it's a falsehood, but what can I do? All right, the Edom are saying what they're saying, so the process is being fulfilled. It's their Avera. So that's not the attitude he should take. If he sees that there is a travesty happening, so he's got to stop it. So that's also applied to this pasuk, Midvar Sheker Tirchot. So in that sense, it is from the pasuk.
I'm talking about that advocate. Why can't we have both? If the problem is a partner of Shachter hearing it from their mouth, so that you can hear it from them, but also somebody can put forth the best claim possible for that defendant.
Through an advisor or through actually being the advocate?
Well, whichever way.
So it's an interesting
point.
You
can hear them, like, meaning that it's not necessarily right.
Well, if they're doing all, if the advocate's doing all the speaking, then you're not hearing that.
Right, so.
So that's the Metzius, which she's concerned about. And even separate from that, and he addresses that even just advising sometimes could lead to a big kippel hadin. He tells a story about how he was involved in a din Torah, and he started to ask one of the defendants about, or one of the litigants about the facts of the case, and the Torah right away said, you don't have to answer that. He said, well, you don't have to answer that. He's trying to figure out the facts, and this guy is getting in the way and saying that the dying should not be exposed to all the facts. He knows if he's got some right to remain silent. So, you know, that's going to lead to a kilkul adin. It happens to be that this is a whole separate topic, so we'll talk about it. Actually, this is a good Sunday topic. But, you know, the Mishnah, which says, we have one Mishnah against every profession. So we have a Mishnah against doctors, so you have a Mishnah that sounds like it's against lawyers. So the common interpretation is that it's not talking about lawyers, it's talking to a judge. A judge shouldn't act like a lawyer. Essentially the same usage here. But it's interesting, if you look in the Rambam, you look in other Mefarshim, there are some other concerns that even just what we talk about advising people how to win, when it may not necessarily bring out the emes lamito in terms of mishpat, is a complicated endeavor. But that's maybe a topic for another Sunday to come to. There's actually quite a lot written about that. But in any event, so the Gemara has other drushes that a Talmud Chacham shouldn't sit with somebody not qualified. It's also, again, relevant to sugyas that we've seen, who may incline him to false arguments. He may end up discussing the sugya with people who aren't really going to be qualified to have the discussion, and he may be influenced. The Gemara also says that if there's a Talmud who's sitting there and sees that there's something going wrong, so he shouldn't just be silent and let it happen again. So all of these drushas from the Gemara, you see that they are interpreting Tirchak, really, that they're saying that it's not only telling you not to lie, but it's telling you that there are steps you have to take to keep a falsehood from happening. In addition, the Gemara says we shouldn't let one person dress fancy and one person dress less fancy, because that's also going to tilt you. So you have a pretty extensive applications which all seem to be in the vein of keeping you farther away from lying, and not just prohibiting lying by itself. You find the Orcha Sadikim says it's important to keep records and mumminous issues, because you might say, all right, I'm not lying, I just don't know the truth, I'm just guessing. So you should keep your words from being sheker, even if you're not intentionally lying, which is also relevant to the whole Lashon Hara consideration, as we mentioned also, that part of the concern is you think you're saying something factual, but there might be all kinds of deficiencies in that. And that's also part of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. Tirchak means not only don't lie, but don't let lies happen around you, through you, to you. Don't let there be sheker in the world. There is some discussion about whether this includes all kinds of sheker, even relatively benign sheker. If you say the sky is green, is that covered by a Midvar Sheker Tirchak? There's no question that it's highly encouraged, to be honest, in all contexts. We have Pesukim and Tehillim that are quoted. We have the idea that Chosamo Shel Kodesh Baruch Hu Emes, that God's seal is truth, that truth is definitely one of our key midos in life. But in terms of this prohibition, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, so does that apply in every context? So it's interesting to perhaps compare it to American civil law. So in American law, American criminal law, that if a person says the sky is green, a person says something false, so then they don't go to jail. They could get elected to public office, perhaps, but they don't go to jail. That's not a crime. It's not a crime to say something false. But it becomes a crime, let's say, in two contexts. If you're in a formal setting, let's say in court, so that's perjury, or if you deprive somebody of their money, let's say, if you defraud somebody, so then that's a crime. So that's something you could end up going to jail for. So you find in the Rishonim and other sources, you find both possibilities. One, that Midvar Sheker Terchak is about perjury, that it's about specifically in formal contexts. Some point out that the rest of the pasuk says in Aki Tzadik Al Taro that you shouldn't end up executing an innocent person. So perhaps it's telling you the context is Bez Din Din Nefashos. The context is not some just Milud Alma. And these drashos from the Gemara in Shavuos are Bez Din oriented. There are others who say that it's like fraud. So this is the position of the Sefer Yireyim, that the Sefer Yireyim maintains that it's the Isser is ben adam l'chaveiro. So if you're hurting somebody, depriving somebody through telling them something false, that's where you have the Isser. And that might be, as others build on this, the idea that it's motiv l'shanus v'fnei ha-shalom, that we have a heter to fudge the truth in the interests of shalom, so some understand, because it's simply not a violation of midvar sheker tirchak, because it's not destructive, it's not harmful. So if it's constructive, adarabba, it's going to be certainly okay. Right, it's going to be perhaps even required because of the imperative of shalom. It's interesting also that the Litzke Rav from Zalman Sirotskin writes in his commentary here that maybe that's how we should understand the idea of tirchak, that we stay away from, meaning that we're not going to say it's aser because we understand there are circumstances where it's necessary. But one should have enough respect for MS that he should try to set up his life that he's not put in these situations too often. So when your back is against the wall and the only way to keep the peace is to be Mishan, is to deviate from the truth, okay, so we see the Gemara, there's a heter for that. But if you're careful, you could try to set up your life that you're not put in that situation. Maybe that's how the pasuk should be read. Midvar Shakir Tirchok, try to distance yourself from these situations where you need to say something false. Even if it's justifiable. So, vice versa, right?
So, like, the prime example is going to a wedding and, you know, case in Moroccan. So
yeah, maybe
you should prevent yourself from going to weddings.
God forbid. So, that's a mitzvah. So, it's interesting that there you find, so, first of all, the fact that the Shammai invokes that issue, the Midvar Sheker Tirchak there. So, our year's reference was actually a sugya we saw last year. That the Gemara says, everyone knows this from the wedding, that Kates and Barakim is Ne'akala, Kalanov, Chasuda. So you say the bride is beautiful. So the wedding band, they don't quote the rest of the Gemara, but that's only the opinion of Beis Hillel. And Beis Shammai objects. Beis Shammai says, what if you're not so impressed? So doesn't the Torah say, Midvar Sheker Tirchak? So you see from there that not everyone agrees it's limited to Bezdin. Apparently Beis Shammai felt this was also an application of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. But Beis Hillel disagrees, and it's very fascinating to analyze exactly the nature of the disagreement, because Beis Hillel's argument is basically, come on, what do you want from me? And he says, what do people do? That if somebody, if somebody buys something from the store and it's not refundable, so what are you going to do? Are you going to tell them it was a lousy deal? No, you'll tell them that it was a good deal. So too, when there's a commitment already, you're not going to hurt his feelings, you're not going to cause a lack of appreciation between the couple. Rather, says Beis Hillel, the person's attitude should always be one that gets along with people, one that works well with others, and therefore it's appropriate to say Kal Nov Chasluda anyway. So there's a lot to discuss about that whole machlokas. It's a fascinating discussion, but there's only so much we can say about it now in the interest of time. But some of the Achronim have a discussion, essentially what seems to emerge, it's Eliezer has a truth about this, others talk about this, that what seems to emerge is that one could have a suffix, one could have a little bit of a discussion, what exactly is the thrust of Midvar Sheker Tirchak? Is it essentially an Isser Midos? Is it saying that it's going to corrupt your character to engage in falsehood? Really, probably in any degree, regardless of whether or not there is a victim? Or should we say, like the Sefer Chasidim seems to be saying, that essentially it is a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, that it's about causing harm to others through falsehood, and therefore there is perhaps more latitude when that's not an issue. Okay, so again, a lot more to say about that, but we need to talk about many other things in this aliyah, so maybe we'll have to find more time in the future to talk about that. But the pasuk, as we said, does end v'daki v'tzadik al taharog. So that is one of the psukim we mentioned in the last semester. That's one of the psukim that is invoked sometimes in the Gemara and in elsewhere in the literature to show that we have a bias towards exoneration in capital cases. We talked about this. That when you have chiyuvei nisa, so there is built into the system a bias towards finding the person innocent, not executing. And among the psukim that are quoted to make that point is this one, v'naki v'tzadik al tarog. And as Gemara indicates, and as the Farshim explained, that naki and tzadik are two different things. So naki is somebody who is actually innocent. So you don't want to execute somebody who's actually innocent. So therefore, you have to do whatever you can to really take care to make sure that's not going to happen. So have all kinds of mechanisms built in order to prevent making a mistake like that. And then v'tzadik is the other way around. So v'tzadik is somebody who is found innocent in bezdin. So he may not be innocent. So then you might say, okay, so if he's found innocent, but later on somebody wants to say, actually, I think he's guilty. So let's reverse it. So no, we're not going to reverse that either. We're not going to undo that because two types of people should be protected from being executed. Either the actual innocent, the naki, or even those who have been already found innocent, the tzaddik. So either way, we're going to protect them both. That's built into the system. And you shouldn't worry or you shouldn't think in either way that Kadosh Baruch Hu is not going to take care of things. Kilo atzdik rasha, God says, I'll take care. If you're worried that he's really guilty, and the Bezdin found him innocent mistakenly, God says, don't worry, I'm going to take care of it. And the implication is the other way around also, that I'm not going to allow you to go ahead with, or I'm not going to exonerate you if you're going to go ahead with executing somebody who doesn't deserve it. Okay, so clearly that pasuk is very, very relevant to our Masechta this year, as was the previous pasuk. And is the next pasuk. So the next pasuk is the Isser Shochad, the Isser of bribery, V'shochad lo sikach, ki ha-shochad yaver pitchim, yisalef divrei tzadikim. So one should not take a bribe, because bribes are bad. Bribes will make sighted people blind, will cause people not to be able to see, and will pervert the words of the righteous. It's going to have a bad effect on din. So it's true, clearly, that a bribe could have that effect of changing the conclusion in an incorrect direction, but there's more to it than that. The Gemara tells us, first of all, that the word shochad is a composite meant to suggest, what the Gemara says in Subas and Dafkapayim and Aleph, shehu chad, that a person feels a connection with somebody else who has done something for them. So we're worried about that. We're worried that if somebody gives you a little bit of a gift, so you're going to feel too identified with them, and it's going to be very hard for you to adjudicate honestly. But it's also important that the Gemara says, you see, that the Isser is not only to try to intentionally get the wrong psak, because the Torah already tells us, lo sata mishpat, we're not allowed, those adayin's not allowed, to tilt the judgment in the false direction. That's clearly a violation of the whole spirit of din. So the Gemara says that there's an Isser Shochad, even if you're trying to get the right result. Shochad to pay the judge to say the right psak is also going to be a problem. So the Torah Tamima tries to figure out what exactly is it that what we're trying to do here, that if it's going to be the right answer anyway, so what's the purpose of the Shochad? So he notes from Tosfos and Bechoros and that Chavtes and Aleph, sounds like you might want the judge to go even further in your direction. So he says he doesn't think that's pshat, because that's also included in losat and mishpat, even if it's a question of degree. So he goes to various possibilities, says that maybe we're talking about early on in the process where the Baal Din doesn't know where things are going to go, so he wants to pay for that. Or maybe we're talking about the opposite end afterwards, he's already had the judgment. and as an isser on the dayan to accept even then. But probably Pashup Shot is that you don't have to work so hard to figure out what's going on. It's that even if it seems like this is consistent with where we should go anyway, that we have to worry that there is a subconscious bias that's going to come from this, even if the dayan thinks he's not taking a turn away from the truth. And who knows what kind of impact that has on the overall story, even subconsciously. And the Torah Tzvina himself says that when he notes the end of the Pasuk, Yisalef, the great Tzaddikim, that there's going to be a perversion of the law. That he says the tendency will be, and this again is evocative of other things that we spoke about this week, that let's say if a dayan happens to be benefiting financially from somebody, so it's not always the case that he's going to say, all right, because I was paid, I'm going to decide he's innocent no matter what. But he's going to want to believe that the guy is innocent. So he'll find ways in his mind that the svaras are going to work out, and he's going to end up with a Ziyafat Torah. He's going to end up being the salad to that truth. He's going to push his own instinct in a way that's going to say this person is justified, and that's not appropriate. That's a problem. Hi.
Also, I mean, everyone thinks that they're right. So if everyone was engaging in bribery, that would be a breakdown of...
Right, so clearly it's a bad policy no matter what. Right? Which is also what we see here in terms of policy. So, for example, the Gemara also says that you can't take shochad even if you're taking shochad from both sides. So we might say, all right, well, what's the danger? I got shochad from everybody, so it's win-win, right? So I get a good parnasa and everything evens out. So it may not actually be win-win, but it'll be a benefit for a lot of people. So the Drisha says the issue is low plug, that even if you're getting from both sides, we can't allow any kind of bribery because of its clear destructive direction. And the Meiri says that even though you're getting it from both sides, so this is already going to start tilting you, even if it's two opposing tilts that are going to balance each other out on the surface, it seems. But already now your thinking is based on this. So your hachra is not going to be on you did MS, it's going to be on which bribe tilt pushed you over the edge, even if they're equal, but which one influenced you in a way that ends up winning out. Which again is evocative, we spoke about yesterday, about the concern that the dying's process of thought is not necessarily going to be pure MS, but it's going to be pushed by other things. It says in Siman Tes in Shulchan Aruch, it's interesting, by the way, so these two psukim that we just had back-to-back about Midvar Sheker Terchak and Shochad, which we see in the Torah, are related in context, and again, both relevant to our Masechta. So in Siman Tes and Chosh Mishpat, that's where you find both. You find some of these dinim of Midvar Sheker Terchak, and first you find the dinim of Shochad. So the Shulchan Aruch says that it's not right to take Shochad, and presumably you have Shochad, you shouldn't then be done somebody. He doesn't say it straight out over there, but the Gemara has examples of this, that somebody received even what looks like some kind of shochad, meaning that it wasn't actual overt bribery, but if somebody gets even a little bit of benefit from somebody else, they feel like they can't be impartial. So Gemara tells stories over there in Ksufis about Dayanin, who received very small favors from people. And then they found out that this guy has a case in front of them. They said, okay, I can't do it anymore. I can't be your dayan because now I'm already influenced because he did this favor for me. So, but what about, let's say he's going to not take the case, but can he keep the money? So is this gezel? So it sounds like in the Shulchan Aruch says that if the guy asks for it back, you have to give it back to him. But this was not legitimate, this is not a real transaction, and you have to give it back to him. So it sounds a little bit like if the guy asks for it back, then the implication is mochel. That's how the Bach understands also the Rambam, which is interesting because the Rambam, then this would be similar to how he understands ribbis. The Torah says you're not allowed to pay ribbis, and even the one paying is not allowed to willingly pay ribbis. And once the dying receives, once the lender receives the ribbis, so then he's obligated to give it back. So that second part, the obligation to give it back, so the Rambam says if the original borrower is mochel, then he doesn't have to give it back. And the Gaonim disagreed. That was a big machlokas. It's a different subject. But Bach suggests that the Rambam is saying the same in both places, that it's wrong to take the ribbis in the first place, it's wrong to take the bribe in the first place, and in both cases you should give it back, but the original giver can be mochel, and then you're not obligated to give it back. And there's a machlokas later svarim, the Bikki Yosef, the Shlitz Yaakov, about whether you should give it back, let's say, Sedei Shamayim, even if he doesn't ask. But the Aruch HaShulchan notes that this is not just about Dayanim. It's true about all public officials, and that's something I'll talk more about in a moment. There's a journal called Shari Tzedek. It's a beautiful journal about the topics of Din and Mishpat, and, things related to our Masechta. It's a journal that comes out regularly, so they have many contributions from prominent Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael, and Dayanim here, some associated with our yeshiva. Shefta's written there, Baruch's written there, Barisa's written there. And so the last one just came out just now, in the 16th volume. So there's a whole section about shochad by public officials, about the issue of bribery, not just by judges, but what we see in certain cultures where people take it for granted that they need to bribe the public officials. So here has a whole discussion about this. The issue of bribery, so the issur is really on the dayan to get the bribe. The person who's giving the bribe is in violation of lifnei iver. So there is a discussion along those lines. So, all right, normally you shouldn't give a bribe. That's asur also because of lifnei iver. But what if the other guy you're dealing with also gave a bribe, so you need to offset it. You need to kind of bring things just back into balance. That's a suffik in the Birkei Yosef. It's a suffik in the Chidah. But it sounds like the general attitude is that's also wrong. It's also lifnei iver. It's certainly an avera for the dying to accept the shochad. So to be involved in that is probably a lifnei iver issue. The Chavos Yair assumes that when it comes to Bnei Noach, when it comes to a secular court, that there's a distinction. That we've spent many times, I discussed many times this year, the position of the Ramban, that all of the Surim of Choshen Mishpat, all the mitzvahs of Choshen Mishpat apply to Bnei Noach also. That's how we understood the mitzvah of Din. And the Rambam understood it differently. We mentioned that a few times. So that could perhaps affect this question. So what if somebody wants to give a bribe to a civil court judge, to a secular court judge, not to pervert the law, but in order to uphold the law, and he feels he needs to give a bribe for that purpose. So the Chavos Yair suggested that if he's trying to get the opposite of the truth, so then clearly that's a perversion of the din, and that's the opposite of the mitzvah of the din, no matter who you follow in terms of what the mitzvah of din is. So that should be asur for sure. But in order to uphold the truth, which Gemara says is asur by Yisrael, so he thought that that maybe isn't included, which maybe depends on this whole Rambam Ramban about whether all the technical dinim of Choshen Mishpat apply. The Urim V'Tumim points out that there's a svar to say it should be okay, because by Bnei Noach, even a karov is acceptable. So if a person could literally be the father of a litigant and still be a dayan, so then the bribe is not going to be more of an endearment than that is. So it makes sense that, again, as long as it's not actually trying to pervert the din, that maybe it should be mutter. So the Chasam Sofer says that if the other guy gave a bribe, so again, you need to set things straight, so then maybe in the Bnei Noach court, it should be mutter for that purpose. So that seems to suggest the chiluk. So we said that same stuff like a few minutes ago in the Din Shel Yisrael, that it seems like it should be aser, but here maybe by Bnei Noach, maybe there are other mechanisms, maybe it's a different svara, maybe there might be a different attitude. But of course, the whole path of bribery in any case is a very dangerous one, a very slippery slope, and one that's essentially synonymous with corruption in general, and therefore there are many, many reasons to stay away from it, as was discussed in this article in the Shari Tzedek. In general, there was also a takana, which is about 500 years old, 450 years old, in 1587. So there was a takana that you should not allow anyone to obtain a public position through payment. Somebody's going to become the rav of the city, become a dayan, become somebody else of public authority through buying the position. So that's, they made a takana not to allow that. That's discussed at length in the Tshuvas Menachos Elazar and also in the Tshuvas Avinezer. I think those were two of the greatest Hasidic poskim, authors of Shalos and Tshuvas, who happened to be Hasidic rabbis, the Minchat Rebbe and Sofchat Rebbe. So it's also interesting, there's a question in general, when you make a takana, when you make a cherem, when you make a social policy, did that mean to suggest that it was mutter before that? Or no, it could be usser anyway, but there's a need in order to address some kind of public problem to make this public policy. So here there's a difference in nuance. Both of these poskim strongly endorse this policy, strongly endorse this takana, but the Menaches Elazar assumes that it was necessary because there could be a shita that this isn't technically a problem. And the Alinezer assumed that it's meikra than a problem, and they had to make a takana in order to strengthen it, in order to make sure that people don't misunderstand. Hi.
I'm curious in America if a judge can be the father of one of the litigants.
I would assume in America they actually wouldn't allow that. So that's also something to consider. One of the things that he discusses with Chaim Vidal in this article, and there's a number of articles about Shochet in this newest issue if one wants to take a look, specifically about these issues, and he talks about the more common scenario, or the more common scenario where in various cultures, maybe it's more of a given, that you're not trying to bribe a judge, but you have a public official who, let's say, a building inspector, so you wait forever to get your building approved. Or if you pay him, it happens quicker. So maybe you should say, all right, there, it's not a din between you and somebody else. Nobody's losing out. So should that be okay? So clearly it's different, but it's also corruption. It's wrong for him to be taking it in the first place. So he discusses there how you have Dina Demochus Adina, and you have whatever the minig is in terms of what's considered appropriate. So whether or not this is absolute shofar on the Torah level, when you're dealing with din, that's one thing, but certainly there are all kinds of reasons why this is problematic. He notes also the Tosfos of Basra that the Gemara talks about a concept called Shud the Daini. We went to Babetzia a few years ago, I don't know if anyone was still here back then. So, Davmi remembers that in the beginning of Babetzia. So, you talk about, what does the first mission of Babetzia talk about? How you, right? Yachloku, right? How do you decide to deal with a stalemate between two people fighting over something? So throughout Shas, there are different mechanisms. Sometimes we say Yachloku, sometimes we say Kold Al Mivar, they fight it out in various ways. There's a concept called Shudu D'Daini. So what does Shudu D'Daini mean? So some of the Rishonim understand that it means there's no other way to decide. The Daini can decide based on whatever he wants, that one side wins, the other side wins. So Tosfos says whatever he wants, so then what's to stop him from taking a bribe? So then let somebody pay him, and that'll be the reason why he'll decide one way or another. So Tosfos says, no, that then he's not even called a dayan. He's got to be a dayan, and if he's taking a bribe, then it's not even called a dayan. So he discusses this, how certain public functions, you need to have a certain level of integrity, even if the process isn't objective, even if the process itself could allow for certain hefkerness in how it happens. But still, the bribe is inherently corrupt, and that's problematic on a lot of different levels. Okay, a lot more to say about that, but we're going to run out of time, so just to quickly look at the many other topics that we find in the rest of the Saliyah. So, V'shei Shonim Tizra Es Artzacha V'Asafta Es Tavasah. I was skipped also, Pasuk and Ideas always often skip, so we should also mention that Pasuk Tes talks about not oppressing the ger. And of course, it's one of the many, many references in the Torah that one should be careful to sympathize the ger in every sense of the word. Whether we're talking about a convert, or we're talking about somebody who's dislocated, somebody who's alone. So the Torah emphasizes to have special rachmanis to him. So it's just said this in Revi, it just said this in the previous Aliyah. And now it says it again. It's an example of a continued emphasis in the Torah. We're told again and again that you were in this context, and so therefore you have to also be especially careful to appreciate what it's like to be like that and to not mistreat people who are outside of their comfort zone. So then the Pasuk talks about Shemitah, V'shei Shonim, Tizra, Es Artzecha, V'Asafta, Es Tavasah, and so it's a comment here that one is totally in the other, that if you observe Shemitah, so you have a bracha for the other 6 years, so you'll be able to plant for those 6 years. And then the next pasuk tells us the mitzvah of Shemitah, the mitzvos, v'hashviyas tishmetena u'netashta, v'yachlu ev'yoni amecha, v'yisram tochal chayasa sodeh, kein ta'aseh l'charmecha l'zeizecha. So what exactly is the interpretation? This is laying out the rules of Shemitah. So tishmetena unetashta, so it's really a double phrasing there. So you should leave it alone and you should abandon it. So in the drashos and chazal and the mafarshim, we have different interpretations, whether this is talking about shemitas karkos, especially, that we're talking about two different aspects of it. Are we talking about not working the land and also leaving all the fruit after, leaving all the produce after the time of the year? Or is it a reference also to Shemitah's Ksafim, which we spoke about at length at the beginning of the year? So there's a little bit of discussion as to what exactly is included in this. There is a fascinating comment to the Meshech Chachma over here in this pasuk, but maybe we'll mention in a moment because it actually ties into another pasuk. So the next pasuk first says, Sheshus Yamantasa Ma'asecha Uviyom HaShvi Tishbos L'man Yanduach Shorcha V'chamorecha V'nofesh Ben Amosecha. So then the pasuk concludes Shabbos also in here and tells us Tishbos that we should rest on Shabbos. So this usage of Tishbos, so many of the Rishonim understand that this is one of the indications in the Torah that on Shabbos we don't only have a prohibition of not doing malacha, but there's a mitzvah saseh of Tishbos. We should have an atmosphere of rest. So what exactly that means, how do we interpret that as beyond the Issa Malacha? Is this just a strengthening of the Issa Malacha? Is this saying that the Issa Malacha is not only an Issa, but it's a Lav Yaseh? It's also got a positive mitzvah attached, or does it include something more? So many assume that it does include something more. The Ramban is very well known. The Ramban in his commentary to Parshas Emor, where he says that there is a concept of Shabbason, that Shabbason is also telling us that we should have an atmosphere of rest on Shabbos. So he says we shouldn't engage in Tircha. We shouldn't be working harder than normal, even if it's not technically a malacha. That would also be a violation of Shabbos in a positive sense. This is relevant this time of year, question of shoveling snow on Shabbos. So there are those who felt that shoveling snow is a malacha, and there are those who felt it isn't a malacha. Rabbi Shlomo Orman, Bechon Lebracha, and his sefer on Shabbos, Oros HaShabbos, so he discusses that it's not a malacha, but he thinks it's a problem of Shabbason. It's not the Shabbos thing to do. So clearly we don't do it for fun. The question is when it's a sakana, when it's got other issues in terms of its public necessity. So that's a different question. But I think we could agree that as far as it, when it's not necessary, so Shabbos now is not Shabbos day, and he suggests that it's an issue of Shabbason. The Rambam has a language in Mishneh Torah.
Is this kind of said that it's...
This is the great Gaon Rav Shlomo Orman, the Chetarik of Racha, author of the Oros HaShabbos. So in the Rambam, in Mishneh Torah, in Parakhaf Aleph, so he talks about this concept of Shabbason, and then he understands it to mean the Shvusim, to mean the Gzeres Rabbanim, which is a little complicated because he's talking about the pasuk, and then he says also, what are they talking about? It's talking about these dinim, which are the Rabbanim. So that's actually a little bit of a synergy also for our Sunday topic, that it seems the Magen Mishnah and others try to figure out what the Rambam is doing here. Some understand the Rambam as being similar to the Ramban, talking about this atmosphere of Shabboson, while perhaps a little more likely what the Rambam is saying is that the specific dinim d'rabbanan that we have, yeah, those are d'rabbanan, but the Torah is telling us that we should also make them, that Chazal should enact these dinim d'rabbanan, because we have to understand we have the absolute malachos d'raisa, and then we have other things which may not be malachos, but are similar enough to malachos, that we should also stay away from them, and Chazal were then given the task of figuring out exactly what that is. So again, this is very relevant to what we're going to talk about this Sunday and last Sunday. Again, a good segue and synergy, that the idea is that there is a instruction from the Torah to engage in making fences and creating a siag and a gather, and that can come from the Torah, while the details can still be the Rabbanan, the point that we're going to have to discuss more on Sunday. Hi.
Many gezeirah derabbanan are in order to prevent you from violating the deraisa, so maybe it's related to, in that way, meaning the Rambam means that, you know,
protect the derisive by making, yeah, that's what it seems to be. I think it's a likely understanding. And then it's interesting because then that comes up again in the next pasuk. So again, this is very synergistic with what we're talking about. So the next pasuk says, "V'chol asher amarti aleichem tishameru, v'shem Elohim acherim lo sezkiru lo yisham al picha." So Rav Sham Shmuel Fel Hirsch comments here that this is a general azhara to people that we should protect the mitzvahs, we should make gezeiros. Again, the same idea that we've been talking about on Sunday, that the Torah conveys that this is something that should happen, both on an individual level and a communal level, and then this discussion, how do we know that the Chazal actually have the authority to do that on our behalf, but the notion, the mentality that we should have such safeguards, so that's something that's conveyed in the Torah in a couple of places. So, the first comments that that's also what the rest of the pasuk is saying, that V'shem Elohim Acherim lo says Tiru, lo Yisham Al Picha, you shouldn't mention the names of other gods, you shouldn't let them come out of your mouth. So he says, that's not a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is worshipping other gods. Why shouldn't you mention other gods? So the church writes that the Pasuk is showing you an example of what a Gezeirah is, that even though the real issue is idolatry, but it's not a good idea to be involved with other gods at all. So therefore, the Torah says this is something that's a distancing, it's kind of a safeguard approach as an example of what we mean in general. The Meshech Chachma has a comment over here, as I alluded to before, it's two Pasukim earlier, on Pasuk Yud Aleph, which is an interesting idea. I'm not 100% sure what he's getting at. He says that here we have Shemitah and we have Shabbos. We have a couple of references like that, and the Torah telling us to watch out for them, and also mentioning this idea of Shmos Elohim Acherim Lo Says Kiru Lo Yisham Al Piyuvah. So the Meshech Chachma says, what's the connection between all of them? He says, one might come up with an idea that maybe, okay, he has to take off for the Shemitah year, he has to take off for Shabbos, so maybe he'll enter into a Shutfus with a non-Jew, and the non-Jew will take all the profit from the Shemitah year, and take all the profit from Shabbos, and he'll do all the rest. So that idea exists. I don't know whether this isn't exactly what we call the Hetzem Mechira. I don't know whether he was addressing the Hetzem Mechira kind of mentality or not. Meshech Chachma died in the 1920s. The Hetzem Mechira was promulgated first in the 1880s. During his lifetime, I don't know exactly where he lined up in the whole discussion, but this isn't exactly what he's describing here. But in any event, he seems to understand that the Torah is saying you might have such an idea, but that's not the appropriate attitude. So he suggests that's what this next pasuk is then coming to say, that you should not only observe Shabbos, observe Shemitah, but also you should protect the whole institution, that there actually should be rest on Shabbos and rest during the Shemitah year. And the Gemara says, you know, the whole idea that we have of a concern of entering into a shukfus with an Obed Avodah Zarah is because we're afraid that he's going to, one of the issues is we're afraid he's going to get into a fight with you and he's going to take a shvua in his name, in his God's name, or like you take a shvua. So the Torah says, remember that we have this issue of Yisham Al Picha, that you shouldn't cause other gods to be mentioned. So that is relevant to this whole idea you might have of entering into such a shudfus. Okay, so here the Torah makes again reference many times to the idea of the Moadim. So we'll just very quickly make reference to something obviously comes up many times in the Chumash. So just mention quickly that the back of Kamenetsky in the Sefer and Chumash notes here, you see this Chag HaHatzir, Chag HaAsif, that it's interesting that the Torah seems to always connect these Yom Tovim to agricultural markers. And yes, is that really what it's about? That's really what we care about? So he has a couple of suggestions. He says one is that the Jewish belief, as opposed to non-Jewish belief, is that we worship God not only through being spiritually minded, but also through Gashmius, not the ascetics, but we also believe in elevating the Ruchnius, elevating the Gashmius into Ruchnius. So yes, we do take note in the course of our Yom Tovim, the times when we're B'fnei Hashem. So we take note of the fact that all of these agricultural things are taking place. He also suggests that we see, for example, in the second paragraph of Kriya Shema, that there's an idea that when we're behaving properly, so God will also make the agricultural work out for us. So in order that we should be inspired to continue spiritual growth, we also take note of the fact that we have these agricultural markers which are synchronized with our Yom Tovim. The Swam Derech, Simchas Lebroi, has discussion about this also, and he notes that the idea of Hashkafa, that we are also taking cognizance of God's providence in the world, of His taking care of everything, so that's also part of the mentality that we're emphasizing by highlighting the agricultural components of all of the Yom Tovim. So, just to say a few words about a topic that one could certainly spend the whole semester on. So, the Aliyah ends with one of the three times in the Torah where it says, Lo Sevashel Gidi V'Chalei Vimo, which is a very striking idea. It's one of the core elements of contemporary Jewish observance, which is why it's such a major theme, halacha l'maisa, the prohibition of basa b'chalav. So it's fascinating. Again, this issue appears three times in the Torah, so the Gemara assumes that even though it's always talking about bishul or sevashul gibi, but it must mean that there are three different isurim, or three related isurim, that are involved. There's the isur to eat basa b'chalav, but there's also an isur to cook basa b'chalav, as the Torah actually says, and there's an isur hana. So we spoke yesterday about the kuda nifla, about the Rambam's point, that there is a relationship directly between the isur achila and the isur hana, but there is more of a discussion to have as well. So just in terms of the Tamei HaMitzvot, there's a little bit outside of our scope for today because there's not so much to say about this, but the Rambam happened to say in Mor Nevuchim, a somewhat controversial idea, that he understands that this was a practice of Ovdei Avodah Zarah in the time of the Torah, that they would cook meat and milk together, and that's why the Torah prohibited it. So that's the kind of idea that some would find controversial, because it tends to separate us from feeling connected to this. So it's very striking that endeavor in general about assuming that the Sermon of the Torah, where it's not explicit that that's the case, that they're connected to some kind of reality that was culturally prevalent. It's especially striking in this area because here, Bishul Basa B'chalav in general, is one of the most practically relevant things nowadays, even though we're so long separated from this culture that the Rambam talks about. But this is one of the most practical halakha concepts that we have. I think probably every Orthodox Jew makes a decision at least once a day because of the halachas of Basa B'chalav, so it's more relevant than pretty much any other halacha in the Torah in terms of its practical application. It's very constant. But there's a lengthy discussion about the hashkafa behind Basa B'chalav in Rav Hirsch's writings, so you could take a look there for much more to say about this. But just to discuss from a Lamdishal perspective, and also to tie it into other issues of our Masechta and of what we're holding in now. So the issue of Bishul Basa B'chalav, that the Torah specifically uses that word for all the three contexts. So is there what note about Bishul specifically, or is it the other way around? So it sounds like from the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah and Hilchos Tumas Meis and Perek Aleph Halacha Beis notes that he thinks the Rambam understands that really the issur of bishul basa b'chalav is actually secondary, that we don't really care so much about bishul basa b'chalav, that really the issur in the Torah is eating basa b'chalav. That's what we are meant to avoid. But it seems like it's pretty advisable that you should not cook basa b'chalav, because if you're not supposed to eat it, so then cooking it would probably be a bad idea, because what are you creating it for when you're not allowed to eat it in the first place? So that Kesef Mishnah says this. It does sound like that also from the Rambam's language in Halachos Machalos Asuris, that that's really the issue in Bishul Basa B'chalav. So if that's the case, so then this sounds like this is a gezeirah, again, the topic that we're talking about in our Sanhedrin Sunday context. So it sounds like this is a safeguard. So again, the whole Aliyah, we've seen a couple of places where the Aliyah in general seems to be pointing us towards the issue of being overly careful. It's a theme in this whole Aliyah. Mitvar Sheker, Tircha, Kisha Meru, Shvos, which is at least the fourth time where maybe there's something that's a safeguard in this Aliyah. But one might ask, okay, so we're talking on Sundays about Xeris Drabanan. That's how we generally understand it. It seems like the relationship is that we have dinim in the Torah that are objective, and we have dinim Drabanan that come to prevent us from violating Yisurim in the Torah. So that's not necessarily the whole story. I think I've mentioned in the past that Joseph Engel popularized this idea that there are dinim in the Torah itself that can be understood as gezeros, that can be understood as preventative measures to keep us from violating other Yisurim in the Torah. So this could be an example. And indeed, in his essay, this is in Sefer Lekach Tov, Klal Ches, Joseph Engel has a discussion about whether or not you find in the Torah such a concept, gezeiros min haTorah, and he says, yeah, let me just think over the top of my head, and he gives you 20-something examples. So one of the examples he lists is this idea that the Kesef Mishnah says that visual basa b'chalav is a gzeira to keep us from eating basa b'chalav. So it's interesting to see if that makes a difference. It's also interesting to note that one could take the opposite approach. So it sounds like from the Gemara and Chulin, actually, and this is how some others understand it. Some Sofer has a comment along these lines. The Mecheshes has a discussion about this. That the Gemara says, a circle called Toeva, that you shouldn't eat anything which is disgusting. And the Gemara Chulin has a comment, Kol she'ti'avti l'cha, hareyu b'bal tochel. Anything that I have described as an abomination, that's something that you should not eat. So it kind of sounds like it's the other way around, that Bishul Basa B'chalav is the creation of something that for some reason the Torah finds abominable, and therefore as an outgrowth of that, there's an issur to eat it. So it sounds like it's the other way around, that not that we're told not to cook it because you might come to eat it, but that the issur of Achila is a result of the fact that it wasn't supposed to be created in the first place. It was itself independently problematic. So the Chasam Sofer notes that there's a couple ways to understand that. That's itself a whole discussion, but the idea that Bishul Basa B'chalav is some kind of a gzeira for eating is an interesting one, and it's an interesting question in general to ask, does that matter? So if you're going to assume that there's a din in the Torah that's really a gzeira for something else, so you might say, alright, so conceptually that's why it's there, but it doesn't make a difference to halacha. You have to follow the rules of the Torah anyway. It's not your place to say that if it's a gzeira that doesn't apply, then we're not going to apply the Yisr Minat Torah. We don't even say that generally by Yisr Rabbanan. By Yisr, the Torah, it's hard to say you can make such a leap. So that's what I would have thought, and that's the position that was expressed in the Tshuvas Chazon Nochum. It was written by the brother of the Shabbina Rav. The Shabbina Rav was with Dov Berish Wiedenfeld. So his brother, Nochum Wiedenfeld, writes in his Tshuvas that even though logically sometimes you might say that you could find a space where there's not going to be a relevance to the concern of eating, but still, it's an issur d'oraisa, so it's not our place to say that, oh, it's really a gezeira for that, even if that's the concept. So that's an understandable position, but a lot of great achronim took it the other way and assumed that there was room to find nafkaminas, including his brother, including the Shabbina Rav, has a tshuva where he discusses a shayla, which was also apparently discussed by Moshe Soloveitchik. There was an article in Beisitzva where the Shechter once quoted that Moshe Soloveitchik had the same shayla and gave the same answer, that in a certain lab, they developed a test. You could test a food item to see if it was basa b'chalav or not, to see what it was made up of. And the test itself involved fire. The test was an act of bishul. So the question was, could you do this act of bishul to what might be basa b'chalav in order to ascertain whether it is basa b'chalav or not, and then presumably you would stay away from it if that's what you ascertained. So they both assumed that Shimon HaRav and Moshe Soloveitchik, based on the Rambam, that since the whole issue of bishul is you shouldn't come to eat it because of the bishul, so if the bishul is to keep you away from it to ascertain what is basa b'chalav in the first place, then it should be mutter, which is the kiddush. As Dechemet discusses that maybe, let's say, if you're a hired cook for a non-Jewish person, maybe you should be able to do it also because he's working on the assumption he's not going to let you taste anything, so then maybe you should also allow that. Again, this is quite a leap. It's an interesting idea. This could have other ramifications because there is a Hafladik Pribagadim, and this is just to mention for a minute, again, because this will be very relevant on Sunday. It's part of this whole discussion. Prima Gadim writes that we know there is a concept called Chatzi Shir. Maybe we know, maybe we don't know. But there is a sugya in the 8th parak of Yuma that even though we have a concept of Shirim in the Torah, so if you eat a kezayis of Chazer, so you're Chayav Malkus. If you eat a kezayis of Chametz, so you're Chayav Karz. So what if you have less than a kezayis? You only have a little bit. That's called the Chatzi Shir. So chatzi shir, it's machlokas in the Gemara. We assume it's asur min haTorah to have a chatzi shir. But even if it's asur min haTorah, some assume, based on a phrasing in the Gemara, that that's also a gzeira min haTorah. That really the real problem is the Torah doesn't want you to have a kezayis of chametz or a kezayis of chazer. But you shouldn't have less because once you start, you're likely to finish. So that some understand is a gzeira. It's a whole long discussion, but that's a tip of the iceberg of that discussion. So the Primogadim has a quite amazing comment. There is a medrash which says that a nazir, is not allowed to drink wine, and the Torah says it's also not allowed to eat grapes. So the medrash suggests that really we don't care if a nazir eats grapes. What's the point in stopping a nazir from eating grapes? Really nothing. It's really a gzeira. He shouldn't come to drink wine. But again, it's a din min haTorah. So the Primogadim had a chiddush that a nazir is allowed to have a chatzi shir of grapes. He's allowed to have less than the quantity of a grape because it's a double gezeira. Having less than a full shir is a gezeira, and grapes itself is a gezeira for wine. So we have a rule, ein gozrin gezeira li gezeira. We don't have double gezeiras, so therefore it should be mutter. So I'm surprised by that, as was Rav Spangl, because presumably that is based on the assumption that we're dealing with the served rabbanim. So then that's probably, as I alluded to last Sunday, some kind of limitation on how Chazal made gezeiras. But to say that a din min haTorah is not going to apply to another din min haTorah if they're both gezeiras, it's a big chiddush, and that's hard to sustain.
Maybe it's ein derabbanan
tikun. Oh, so it could be. So I suggested that once, that maybe you say the other way around. That explained
it. I was joking.
No, but I think I wrote this once. I think there might be some truth to this. That how do you know that there's ein derabbanan tikun gezeira li gezeira? So there's a tosos in Chulin, which sounds like they just knew it. There's no source for it. So maybe you could suggest, since we do have a principle, that we assume kol tikun rabbanan ke'ein deraisa tiknu, that Chazal patterned their gezeiras after Torah law. So maybe you could say that we can work backwards, that we know that Chazal had this policy. So why do they have this policy? Maybe because they saw that even in HaTorah, that was the policy. That even in HaTorah, the Torah itself wouldn't make gezeiras for gezeiras. Still hard to understand why, but maybe there's a tradition that that's even the Torah itself doesn't have gezeiras. That's something, gezeiras on top of gezeiras. So that's something, again, we could explore a little bit more on Sunday. But if you follow the Primogadim to his logical conclusion, so then, if the Rambam is correct, you could say that it should also be mutter to have a chatzi shir of basa b'chalav, or to cook a chatzi shir of basa b'chalav, because you could say that bishul is a gezeira, and chatzi shir is a gezeira, so that should also be mutter. So it's interesting, Primogadim talks about that shaila elsewhere, and doesn't come to that conclusion. So that's just interesting to consider. It's also noteworthy that you could have qualitative and quantitative chatzi shir. It's also discussed in various Primogadims. What if you're cooking something that's too small? Or what if you're only cooking it halfway? So is that also called a chatzi shir? So one could also note that when we talk about the question of chicken, so I mentioned that on Sunday also, chicken and milk. So we know that that's the drabbanan. That in a Torah you can have chicken and milk, and Chazal have an isser of chicken and milk. So what is that isser? So the Rambam says that the isser is to eat chicken and milk, and cooking chicken and milk is mutter. It's not included in the gezeira. So everyone else asks on him, because first of all, it sounds like it's against the Mishnah. It's a different discussion. But also, kein deraisa tiknu, so if the isser deraisa of basa b'chalav is cooking and eating, so why don't we say also that chicken and milk should also be cooking and eating? So there are various suggestions. You could maybe say that maybe the gzeira logic is here. That maybe if you say the Rambam l'shitaso that cooking is the gzeira and chicken we know is the gzeira. So maybe cooking chicken again is the gzeira and that's why he didn't want to prohibit it. And here you don't have to go as far as the Primogadim. Primogadim says even the gzeira min haTorah and gzeira min haTorah don't apply together. Here we're talking about what would be a gzeira derabbanan. That here at chicken we're dealing with derabbanan, so maybe the Rambam understands that the whole logic of cooking is only a gzeira for eating. So since eating derabbanan itself, eating chicken itself was derabbanan, so then he thought you couldn't prohibit cooking chicken. So again, there are a lot of other tshuvas that discuss the question of whether we can make distinctions within basa b'chalav along these lines. There's another discussion post in Hem. Can you use a candle that's made out of basa b'chalav, or Hanukkah candles, or really for anything? So Hanukkah candles are extra elements to it, but come up for anything. So there, that's going to be an active bishul. You're setting fire to it. It's going to qualify your bishul. But the question is, maybe if it's going to, result the bishul is going to be, it's going to go completely melt. There's not going to be anything you could eat. So should we apply the issur of bishul basul b'chalav to that? So that's a whole discussion, which again ties to this idea that maybe bishul basul b'chalav should be viewed as a gzeira rather than an independent issur. So again, all of this is surprising because normally we have a policy in darshan time with the crop, and you would think that you don't have the room to make any such distinctions, even if logically there's a basis for them. And that was, again, the attitude the Chazon Nochem took. But nonetheless, we recognize the fact that many of the Gedolei HaPoskim in this sugya, in the sugya of Chatzis Shir, a few other sugyas, especially of Chatzis Shir, maybe Pesach time, we could talk about that. It's interesting. But in these contexts, they did seem to be ready to apply nafkaminas, to apply various halachic applications based on the assumption that we were dealing with some kind of a siyag. So this ties in then to the question of what is the issue of gzeira to gzeira. So once again, that will be our perfectly set up segue then to pick up with that on Sunday when we continue with this topic. All right, I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Who's going to daven for us? Josh, you look like you're ready. No? Okay, Sammy, you want to daven for us? Okay.